Well, I am honored to present our keynote speaker for the Blanchard Memorial Lecture today. He's been a colleague and mentor of me and so many other underrepresented and not underrepresented faculty at UCLA. Dr. David Hayes Bautista is a distinguished professor of medicine at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA and the director of the UCLA Center for the Study of Latino Health and Culture. This center not only conducts research on Latino health and social issues, but indeed is a beacon of hope and inspiration to so many young students that have come through the UCLA community seeking careers in the health professions. Dr. Hayes Bautista completed his undergraduate studies at UC Berkeley and his doctoral work at the University of California, San Francisco Medical Center. He went on to serve on the faculty at the School of Public Health at UC Berkeley until 1987, when he came to UCLA. His research appears in a variety of journals, including Family Medicine. Two of his most notable books include El Cinco de Mayo, An American Tradition, and most recently, his second edition of La Nueva California, Latinos from Pioneers to Post-Millennials, which was just released quite opportunely in these times of emboldened anti-immigrant politics. In 2012, he received the Association of American Medical Colleges Hubert Nickens Award for his lifelong concerns about educational, societal, and healthcare needs of underrepresented groups. For the past 5 years, he's been chosen one of the 101 top leaders of the Latino community by Latino Leaders Magazine. And last year, 2016, he won the Oatley Award from the Mexican government for his positive impact on the Mexican diaspora abroad. His career has been one of struggle, vision, and optimism. As an undergraduate student at UC Berkeley, fighting for diversity in his curriculum and student body, later going on to challenge and debunk the seemingly undying myth of the dysfunctional Latino minority, to his current policy and scholarly work and leadership at UCLA, he's had a far-reaching impact on our society. And as you're about to learn, he's an investigative historian with a keen ability of breathing life into data in his quest to inform, universally unite, and heal. Please join me in welcoming Dr. David Hayes Bautista.
Thank you. Can we get my slide up here? Thank you. Well, that's kind of a barn burner of an introduction here with all these torch lighting. And I'm not even going to complain you didn't have Santana, but but back then he was the Charlie Santana blues band, so that's okay. Not a problem. So let me get started on the right foot. I don't have any disclaimers, but I do have a claimer I want to make, which is quickly where we're going to go with all of this, because at some point you might think, what is he talking about? I want us to understand that thing called the Latino epidemiological paradox. Don't worry, in 20 minutes it'll make perfect sense, okay? Then we want to appreciate how Latino immigrants actually strengthen that paradox. We need to understand how the typical social determinants of health we use to try to predict health don't work with this paradox. Obviously, it's a paradox. But then what might? We need to look at alternative social determinants, such as assimilation and acculturation. But I want to make this fun. I know you're looking forward to a great party. I'm all that stands between you and a great 50-year party. And if that's music in any indication, it's going to be a very good party. So before I get to the data, I want to just talk a little bit about myself, my life, and my intellectual journey, trying to understand Latino health. So I'm going to move out from behind this podium and just chat a little bit. Now, I'm a native Angeleno. I was born in L.A., in fact, born down on the harbor. But 2 years ago before UCLA Harbor was founded, so I was not born at UCLA Harbor. If I'd a little bit younger, I may have been, almost. Then raised City Terrace, El Monte, sort of greater East LA. Now, here is the situation. I am an eighth generation American of Mexican origin. My family has lived in this country before this country existed. And when I was growing up in East LA, it never occurred to me I was anything but an American. But when I was 7, my family moved up to San Luis Obispo, about 250 miles north of here, a little town on the central coast that was inhabited by a very different demographic than I was accustomed to in East LA. Okay, so I was in third grade, and in our third grade social studies class, our teacher, Mrs. Kalb, actually had us read the textbook paragraph by paragraph. And she would kind of, you know, walk around the front of the room like this, and she would help us pronounce the really hard words. So we were reading a chapter on South America, and I can still see in my mind's eye the photograph of a couple of young indigenous South American boys just wearing breech clouts, and they're playing with a tropical monkey of some sort. So I was looking at the photograph, and suddenly, oh, it's my turn to read. So I pick up my book, and I start to read that the capital city of the South American country was Asunción. And, well, as soon as the word Asunción came out of my mouth, the teacher stopped. She whirled around, she came over to my desk, she towered over me, and she asked, "What did you just say?" I had just turned 8. I was the new kid in school. I picked up the book again. I said, "Okay, the capital is Asunción. Do you speak Spanish?" I didn't know what to say. I mean, I don't even remember what I said, but she pulled me out of there. I went down to the principal's office, called in my parents, called in the teachers. They conferenced, and after seemed like years, probably 20 minutes, this whole phalanx of adults came out. They faced me and gave me their sentence. I had a speech defect. And I was sentenced to 3 years of speech therapy to correct my defect. And so I went to speech therapy for years, wondering, what's my defect? Now, looking back, I could think my defect was that I pronounced correctly Asunción, the capital of Paraguay. Oop, there goes that defect. Paraguay, capital of Paraguay. Okay. Well, after 8 generations, after 300 years in this country, I was too Mexican to be American. Okay, fast forward to the 70s. I was at UCSF, early days of the Chicano movement, and some Chicano medical and dental students had just rediscovered their Mexican roots. So they jumped into a Volkswagen van, drove all the way down the 101, they crossed the border here into Tijuana, because they wanted to pay homage to the motherland. So literally, the notion we moved into Tijuana, then they stopped the van, got out, they knelt, and they kissed the ground. Motherland! We have returned. And while they were venerating the motherland, some thieves broke into their van and stole all their baggage. And as they were dealing with police sergeants and hotel managers and even restaurant waiters, they were told in so many different ways, "But you're not Mexican. You speak horrible Spanish. Your verbs aren't right. You dress like an American. You act like an American. You walk like an American. You're not Mexican." And they came back to UCSF and just dejected. They went down to venerate the motherland, and the motherland rejected them. They were too American to be Mexican. Well, you know, this was the Chicano dilemma. Too Mexican to be American, too American to be Mexican. We were neither here nor there. As you say, ni de aquí, ni de allá. So where did that put us? Up in the air? Well, you know, that's not a very solid foundation to get anything going. That was the dilemma. In 1988, Stanford University Press published my first academic book. And in that book, I projected, using data from the 1980 census, that by 2030, California would be 45% Latino. Well, right now, we're at 40%. By the way, I hit every decennial census. You can still buy the book. It's still live. I still get a royalties check, about $20 a year from them. That means they sell 20 copies. But what was surprising is after doing all that work, the reaction, the negative reaction. Usually what would happen, somebody come up to me wagging their finger like this, "You mean to tell me by 2030, California will be half Latino?" And I was been such a nerd. Well, I'm not advocating this. The parameters of the equation indicate that. The finger wagger, "Oh my God, it'll be the end of California." Little me back then, the equations are good. What are you talking about? So why? What do you mean? "Well, Americans know how to live. They work hard. They take responsibility for their family. They don't use welfare. They take care of the health. They're not a burden for anybody. But you guys, you're not Americans. You're Mexicans. You're Latinos. You're a bunch of illegal immigrants. You're gangbangers. You're teenage pregnant moms living on welfare. You're going to ruin the state." Well, I'm a researcher, and this was all before they had used that little Hispanic identifier in the census, in the birth file, in the death file, hospital discharge. So we didn't even know how many Latinos there were in the state, much less what was their profile like. I understood that people were kind of repeating what they saw the previous evening's news on English. Okay, and what do you see? The gangbanger, the illegal immigrant, the teenage pregnant moms on welfare. But nobody had any data. So I was concerned because I was getting a lot of negative response to this book. Clearly, for me, California is going to be half Latino. Does that mean that California is doomed to some sort of dystopian future? Well, the way people talked about it, they did. Then, one day in 1989, in my wife's office, she was then at the School of Nursing at UCLA, I found a book that totally changed my life. I mean, it changed me intellectually. It changed my theoretical approach to research. It changed my data collection. It changed my analysis. And it caused me to see Latinos in a very, very different way, and I've never turned back since. Let me share with you the book that caused my intellectual epiphany. Vital Statistics of Los Angeles County, 1986. Okay, I admit I'm a nerd. You know, when other people have epiphanies, there's like this booming voice from above. You have Gabriel's trumpet over here, choir of angels over there. Nah, just give me data. Well, what so impressed me was that for the very first time that Hispanic identifier was used and the health profile of Latinos was taken out, separated from everybody else. And I actually could see Latino health profiles for the very first time. And what I saw just stunned me, just hit me upside the head. Let me share with you what I saw, although I have updated these data from 1986 to 2013. And in my new book, by the way, I do all the data in between. And I've expanded out from LA County to California. And also we can go out to the whole country. But here are the data. Here we have the top four causes of death, California 2013. Heart, cancer, stroke, chronic lower respiratory. In yellow, we have the non-Hispanic white. In orange, Latino. And you know, for the number one cause of death, which is heart disease, and these are age adjusted, Latinos have a 30% lower mortality rate. For cancer, Latinos have a 30% lower mortality rate. For stroke, it's only 10% lower. Okay, you get used to patterns. And for CLRD, 60% lower. And you go to cause of death after cause of death after cause of death, and you'll see similar pattern, anywhere from about 10 to 40% lower, with one exception, which is diabetes, but that's the number 7 cause of death. Then after that, you come back to this pattern. Well, what this does, just to put it into a big bullet point, in terms of life expectancy at birth. For non-Hispanic white, it is 80.1, and for Latino, 83.7, 3.5 years longer. I turned 72 this year. Let me tell you right now, those 3.5 extra years look mighty good. Let me tell you. Now, come on, you heard of Viva la Raza, right? And now we see it in the data. Now, the funny thing is, as we all know, we see these data in a population that has very low income, very low education, horrible access to care. Just horrible access to care. Given that, these outcomes are totally unexpected, so this has been called the Latino epidemiological paradox, which is nice way of kind of boxing it, putting it off to one side, and I keep saying paradox. For Pete's sake, 52% of the babies born in California are Latino. They're not the paradox. They are the statistical norm, just we have paid so little attention. We can't explain how they got into this world. We can't. Our models don't work. Well, I didn't expect to see these at all. And as I put them down, I thought, I just got some new data from the census that did have that Hispanic identifier. So I ran to pull it up, and I saw the same pattern repeated in other parts of social life. For example, here, this is male labor force participation. And it goes from 1940 here, all the way to 2015. 75 years worth of data. 3 generations of workers, and you will notice that Latino males have consistently, over that time, had a higher labor force participation rate than non-Hispanic whites. Higher than any other group, for that matter. 75 years. And Latino males work more hours per week, work more in the private sector, work less in the public sector than any other group. 75 years. These are very stable patterns, very stable. Now, with such an active work ethic, I mean, if you look at the data, then what we hear about welfare, obviously, things don't add up that much to the work ethic. How can they be taking up all the welfare? And sure enough, as we look at three data points here, 1990, before welfare reform, Latinos had a lower welfare utilization rate than whites, during welfare reform, and after. Yet we constantly hear about Latinos, you know, living for generations on welfare. We just don't see it in the data. So, also, Latino households are far more likely and have been for 75 years to be composed of couples with kids. Latinos set up businesses at 10 times the rate of non-Hispanic white. Boy, talk about American behavior. I mean, Latinos behave more like Americans than most Americans. But 2 years ago, when Donald Trump was candidate, he characterized Mexican immigrants. He said, and I'm going to quote him, "They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists." So I would like to share some data about Latino immigrants. And what we see is that actually Latino immigrants strengthen all these paradoxically strong Latino behaviors. I mean, let's just look at labor force participation. Now, here we've disaggregated Latinos into U.S.-born, which is the light green, and the immigrant, which is the dark green. And here we have just 1990, 2000, 2015. This also goes back to 1940. And you notice that the dark green immigrants actually have a higher labor force participation rate than the U.S.-born. And immigrants work even more hours per week, work even more in the private sector, work even less in the public sector. And as we look at welfare utilization, again, in the light green are U.S.-born, dark green are immigrants. Immigrants use welfare far less than the U.S.-born Latinos. Far less. This spills over into health. Here are data from NHIS on reported heart and cancer prevalence. And you notice that immigrants report far lower incidence or prevalence of heart compared to U.S.-born and lower cancer. And actually, we do have some mortality data that corroborate that. Here are some data from the NHANES, 2009 to 2012. And immigrants are less likely than U.S.-born Latinos to be obese and to smoke. And we could also add and to drink and to do drugs and to get a sexually transmitted disease. One result we can see in hard data, infant mortality, and actually immigrant infant mortality is 20% lower than U.S.-born infant mortality, even though the U.S.-born Latina moms have far higher education, far higher income, far better access to care. They also, the U.S.-born Latinas, smoke more, drink more, do more drugs, and acquire more sexually transmitted disease. Isn't assimilation wonderful in terms of health care? Well, all these data are in this new book that was just released 3 months ago, called La Nueva California, Latinos from Pioneers to Post-Millennials. So you want these data and all these, and we even look nationally, they're all right here, a handy-dandy compendium. Now, let me share with you what most people would consider to be a typical American success story. The son of an Indiana steelworker decides he's going to go to college, unlike his parents, goes to college, graduates, goes on to law school. He becomes a judge, and he's a federal court district judge. And he's operating here in Southern California. Okay, this judge is asked to preside over a lawsuit alleging fraudulent advertising for educational services. And when he is assigned to this case, the defendant immediately accuses the judge of not being able to fulfill his role as a fair and balanced jurist, because he is, quote, a Mexican judge, unquote. A Mexican judge. Wait, this was to sound like a typical American success story, right? Until we know, oh, well, but a Mexican did it. Well, it can't be very good then. And you know, the funny thing was, this Judge Curiel, he's not a Mexican. He's born in Indiana. He's a United States citizen. Okay, but you know, I say, hey, we've been doing this for 8 generations. Whatever we do, we're never American enough. So, how is this possible? How is this possible? Well, it all starts all the way back in 1776, when the young United States fought to establish itself as an independent country based on some universal principles, freedom, equality, democracy, that it thought was good for all the world. So it fought for independence, and in that war for its independence and many battles, more soldiers spoke Spanish than English. But that's another presentation, okay? Okay, so the war was won, so some delegates met in Philadelphia to write a constitution for this new country. And the conversations went somewhat on this wise. You had the skeptics. They're saying, so you're telling me we fought this here war because we believe in freedom, equality, and independence? Do we? And other delegates say, well, of course we do. We're patriots. Okay, so when do we free the slaves? Free the slaves! No, we didn't win the war for that! And that's when the concept of nativism got written into our very Constitution. To avoid freeing the slaves, a United States citizen, an American citizen, was legally defined as being born racially white. Those not born white couldn't be citizens. And that quickly expanded to be not only racially white, you had to be ethnically Anglo-Saxon, religiously Protestant, and linguistically English-speaking. That's nativism. If you won the racial lottery, you picked your parents well, you were born an American. And you didn't have to believe in freedom, equality, democracy, or any of these other bothersome values. In 1810, in Mexico, Miguel Hidalgo declared the independence of Mexico from Spain and proclaimed not only the same values, freedom, equality, and democracy that the American patriots had in 1776, he actually acted on them. In the same breath that he declared independence, he also declared racial equality and citizenship. Everyone was going to be a citizen of the country of Mexico, no matter what their racial background had been, and the abolition of slavery, and gave the slave owners 10 days to free the slaves, or he's putting the owners in jail. He was serious about that. Here we are in San Diego. Guess what? This used to be part of Mexico. And these were the constitutional norms that were the rule of law here in San Diego. Real freedom, equality, and democracy. Well, California was taken over by the United States in 1848. So Latino delegates, including delegates from here, from San Diego, traveled to the California Constitutional Convention up in Monterey. And they strode into the hall and they said, we're all Americans in this hall. We all believe in freedom, equality, and democracy. Let's get to work and write a constitution. And some of the non-white delegates said, gee, dang, that's right. If we believe the same things, we must all be Americans. Ah, but a number of delegates, such as the slave owner, William Gwynn, who still had 300 slaves on his plantation in the South, was a nativist. And he was just appalled. He couldn't believe the arrogance of these racially mixed, mestizo, Spanish-speaking Catholics to claim they were Americans just because they happened to believe in freedom, equality, and democracy. So these issues, boom, fought on the floor of the Constitutional Convention. And after 3 months of hot debate, the 1849 Constitución del Estado de California, oh, they also wrote a version in English, English and Spanish were declared the official languages of this latest state of the Union, the 31st state of the Union. Now, I know there are people that try to tell you that Spanish is a foreign language. I don't think so. But more importantly, not only that, Mexico's early abolition of slavery was honored and continued. California came in as a free state. We upset the balance of the Missouri Compromise that led to the Civil War 10 years later. That's yet another presentation, Cinco de Mayo. And non-whites grudgingly were allowed to become citizens. Wow, great accomplishment. However, 5 years later, suddenly we had to start this battle all over again. Because what happened is that the nativists were not happy, and here in California, almost every 20 years, on 20-year cycles, the nativists attempt to impose their racially based definition of America on the rest of society. And the universalists have always got to fight back. California had been a state for 5 years. Along comes the American Know Nothing Party. Remember them? What were they all about? Anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic, pro-slavery. 20 years later, in the 1870s, Dennis Kearney and his Working Man's Party, okay, with their motto, the Chinese must go, tried to rewrite, in fact, they did rewrite the California Constitution to kick all the Chinese out of California and get rid of all the Spanish language provisions. 1890, the American Protective Association, trying to protect America from what? Oh, from immigrants, Catholics, and foreigners. Does this sound kind of, you know, repetitious? 19-teens, Jim Crow laws hit California. California officially segregates everything, public and private, anti-equality. 1930s, we had the massive Mexican deportations of the 30s. One out of every three Latinos was dumped across the border. It didn't matter whether they were a citizen or not. You're Latino, you should be out of here. 1950s, Operation Wetback. About 1.5 million farm workers deported. 1970s, remember the English-only movement began. 1990s, we had the famous Proposition 187 here in California. And now, in 2017, who do we got in the White House? Yeah, we got that guy in the White House with all those white, they don't call themselves supremacists anymore. They're now just nationalists. They don't feel they're better than anybody else. They just want to be separate. So this one group, for example, the Traditionalist Workers' Party, they're headquartered in Indiana. They want to break up the United States into different states, each one inhabited by a single racial, ethnic, cultural, religious group. And they say that this is somehow going to be achieved by, quote unquote, peaceful ethnic cleansing. Yeah, oh yeah, that's kind of like, you know, a cold atomic bomb. I mean, the thing goes, it's going to go. And what they want to do is set up these different states that are monoracial, monocultural, monoreligious. And you read some of Steve Bannon's stuff and some of these other white nationalists, they now call themselves, not supremacists. And you have to wonder, my God, what's going to happen? Well, even if they were to achieve their goal of taking a few states, you know, North Dakota, Iowa, Montana, and ethnically cleansing them, and setting up whatever government they call, those areas will not be American territory because they simply will have turned their back on the founding American principles. Freedom, equality, democracy, government of the people, by the people, and for the people. So they can be whatever they want, they will not be American. We have just passed the first 100 days of this new administration. We got 3 years and 9 months more. What's going to happen to America between then and now? Impeachment notwithstanding. Well, and as you hand in your envelopes, please sign the petition. Just kidding, just kidding. So what will happen to America over the next 4 or 3 3/4 years? Well, I project demographics. I don't project crazy politics. But I can tell you one thing. America will be safe in this room. America will be safe in states, New York, California, Florida, Illinois, because of the diversity of the population. America will be safe in California because of its vigorous immigrant population from around the world. And America will be safe in California because of the 15 million Latinos who every day get up, go to work, by their daily thoughts, words, deeds, and action, reinforce everyday basic American values. Freedom, equality, democracy, hard work, family, healthy behaviors, take care of yourself. America will be safe for the next 3 years and 3/4 because Latinos are Americans. In spite of what I've been told, I finally realized late in my life, we've been Americans all along. We have been Americans, always will be. Diversity. Immigration is the foundation of America. We're here. America is safe with our hearts, with our hands, with what we do every day. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Wow, thank you. I know I love this group.
Well, we love you. Thank you for an inspiring presentation, giving us plenty to think about. We have a few minutes for questions. And there's a microphone set up, so if you would be so kind.
Sure. Steal water.
Hi, David. I'm Denise Rogers from Rutgers. Mm-hmm. And I had a question, actually, since I'm from that other coast. That has a Latino population that looks a little bit different than the Latino population in California. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit, actually, about issues related to race in Latinos, because there's certainly some evidence in birth outcomes, for example, that would suggest that black Latinos may have worse health outcomes than some of the data that you showed here, and how much are people beginning to look at that, and how we address issues of race and racism in Latino communities as well.
Well, actually, don't sit down. Don't sit down yet. Let's chat a little bit.
Okay.
This is the problem for the 21st century. In the health sciences, we have grown up putting people in racial post holes, the whites, blacks, Indians, Asians. And that is a result of a particular racial narrative. Started in 1787 with the Constitution, enshrined in our very first census, 1790. People had to be identified so they could be excluded. We tend to forget that. Mexico and California was part of a different racial narrative that I call the Indo-Afro-Oriental-Ibero racial narrative, because there's been a huge amount of what is called in this country race mixing. But in most Latin American countries, kind of, it is what it is. If you follow the 1,000 genome projects, they've been sampling in Puerto Rico and in Medellin, Colombia, and in East LA. And interestingly, as you look at their findings, everybody in Puerto Rico, everybody in Medellin, everybody in East LA has some indigenous ancestry, has some European ancestry, and has some African ancestors, everybody. Now, by the one-drop rule in this country, that would make all Latinos black, African-American. By the one-drop rule. And that's how you do your RCTs, you know, randomized. If you're going to do it by race, well, your white's got to be here, and your black's got to be there. You know, in this country, our racial narrative does not allow President Obama. He was always a black man with a white mother. Okay, our narrative, a white man with a black man, no, he doesn't look white. That's our racial narrative here. When you look at the census, by the way, Latinos are horribly confused about these racial categories, because that's not how they're not, it's not that Latin America is post-race, it's just a different narrative. That's what we're working on, working with some folks at Drew, which was established as a historically black college and university when the population around it was about 90% African American. Now it's about 90% Latino. And yet, I say by the one-drop rule, nothing changed, but clearly things changed. So we're doing a piece of research on the 2010 birth cohort here in California. Well, before you have to understand in the censuses from the 1980 to 2010, when Latinos are asked what race they are, about half will say, well, I must be white. But you got to understand, when Latinos say white, they might not mean it in the same way. It could mean I'm American, I'm a success, I'm moving ahead. It has a lot of, not necessarily racially, and about half say, well, okay, we got some European, got some African, got some Asian, got some Indian, I must be some other race. And almost half say, I'm some other race. They haven't learned the racial narrative yet. So off of the birth file, we've identified the mothers and fathers when they're of the same quote-unquote race that we use, and when they're of different races that we use, including, of course, Latinos who don't know what race they are, or they say, oh, it must be something else because I don't fit those categories. 41% of the babies born in California in 2010 are what we call racially ambiguous. Well, like Obama, he was racially ambiguous. You could put them here, or you could put them... Now, yes, the U.S. racial narrative, you know, defaults in a couple... And they do get assigned to the different categories. Some algorithms, they assign them the race of the mother. Others assign them the race of the father. And others assign them the most non-white race that they're... I mean, you can assign them, but you just realize, wait a minute, they're ambiguous. If they could go anywhere, how do we measure health disparities when 41% of the babies are racially ambiguous? You can't just withhold them. You can do that at the national level. You know, that's 2.3% of the population is either some other race or two or more races. You can withhold them and everything else fits. How can you withhold 41% of the babies and say, well, now we got internal validity? Well, what's, hello? Okay, so we got some problems there in terms of those race categories. And then on top of that, of course, the millennials. They really resist categorizing themselves that way, too. And what you see in the census, what race are you? I'm purple. You know, I'm green. I mean, they don't want to play that game. Well, we have been accustomed to sorting all of our research by these race categories. And I'm telling you, by the year 2030, in places like California, New York, Illinois, Florida, Texas, they're going to be scientifically meaningless. Yes, we could continue to do it, but what will we get? So our goal is, what can we use instead of the race categories? Let's stop reifying them. Let's find out what really is going on, and we probably need to do this by the 2030 census, or we're not going to have the data with the validity on these categories that we have inherited for 230 years to do any analysis by racial differences. Now, that's just the context. Maybe that's enough. This is a great issue, and it's really important because our whole scientific structure has been built on the existence, the reification of these groups, and it's just coming to a screeching halt with great diversity, which doesn't mean that we're going to be in a post-race society, and it does not mean we're not going to have disparities. It's just we need to track them differently. And I think we need to track, it's not so much the races from inside, it's the racial narrative that different societies and different populations have had to grapple with, and we need to also look at their community agency in pushing back. So that's why when I hear the thing about race, I get a little bit nervous, thinking, I'm not sure I want to go too far in this conversation, but I think we can get together and have a drink about this. We're going to be submitting a paper, in fact, as we look at these birth outcomes, just showing how the social determinants break down once you start to allow any malleability or ambiguity in these racial categories. So, yeah, it's a big research question.
If I should respectfully just add.
I think we need to go out to the bar.
Yeah, no, we definitely can go out in the bar, and I'll shut up in a second. But I think the issue actually is not necessarily the categories that people choose. And I think Kamara Jones, for example, very powerfully makes the case that what race is about is actually what you are perceived as.
Yeah, so that's the narrative.
But this is the issue. So a black Puerto Rican and a black Dominican in California or Texas or certainly more commonly in New York City is more likely to get treated badly by the police than a white Puerto Rican or a white Dominican, there are fewer, or for that matter, white Mexicans. And so I think because of that narrative and that reality, we are not yet in a situation where we can ignore issues related to race in Hispanic communities. And I'd love to discuss it further over a drink.
And part of what we're doing here, just the final coda, there, I can say it's not that Latin America is post-race. It has its racial narrative. It's just it's different from here. And right here in California, these two narratives are sitting right atop one another. We're trying to sort them through. It's fascinating. Yes.
Thank you very much for your talk and the sharing of your data. As you know, we're awash in alternative data, and that makes this very difficult. I'm from Oregon, which is a fairly homogenous state, if you will, compared to many of the states that you've outlined where Americanism will survive. I'm wondering, as you've looked at the 20-year cycle that you've described, I would hypothesize that there is anger and fear as primary motivators during that period of time. And I'm wondering, at this time, what can we do to help with the anger and fear that mobilized this movement to begin with, to the point where somebody got elected in the way that they have? And what can we do from your perspective, with your background in the history, to help us during this time?
Well, the first thing I'd like to do is get on a plane and go to Paris tomorrow and find out, okay, how did Le Pen manage to lose by 2/3 of the vote?
So that is true, but her father actually got half that amount of vote when he was there. So she managed to get twice as many votes as he did.
Yeah. Partially, this is, as we look at the generations, and I'm a big user of generations in a lot of ways. That's why my book is titled From Pioneers to Post-Millennials. Actually, we're looking at the folks born after the millennials from 1997. And those generations are extremely diverse. When we look at the top 10 metropolitan areas, Riverside, San Bernardino, LA, San Diego, San Antonio, Houston, et cetera, anywhere from 60 to 85% of that generation is not white in the sense that we have used it in our research. Just very, very diverse. And of course, they're all meeting and having kids and everything else. Well, not yet. They're only 18, 19. Things start moving into the birthing cohort. Their lived experience will be different from that older generation, particularly the baby boomers. And I think actually, you know, the questions I'm posing, how do we track disparities without reifying the race categories? Probably we need to listen to them because I think we're going to learn a lot from how they're putting their worlds together. So one of the things we want to do is do some cohort studies on that. I wanted to kind of a Framingham here, just on the issue of race and health outcomes as these things are going to be changing. And we will not be post-racial completely by 2050, but those generations, I think, will be adult and will have a different enough experience that we might get on the downhill side of all this and start to be able to coast a little bit. It's probably going to get a little bit hotter between now and the next iteration. But the next iteration, we're going to have some significant generational demographic shifts. So I don't have an answer, but I want to learn, and I'm hopeful. I'm very, very hopeful just because those younger generations, they grew up in a much more diverse society than the old generations did.
Thank you. Ray Rosetta asked me to remind you that due to weather forecast for today and this evening, we've made the move for the 8 o'clock goal party from the pool deck to the Seaport Foyer. It's located on the second floor of the hotel in the Seaport Tower. The 9 p.m. dance will still be held in the Grand Ballroom as scheduled. I hope you can attend all events.
Hey, wild horses could keep me away.
Thank you so much for your presentation.